I don't want a tickle. Just want to ride on my motorcycle. All right, and we're at episode 6.
Yep.
Oh my gosh. Let's talk bikes.
Let's do it.
Okay, so starting this off, we've had... You got a cough?
Yeah.
Okay, so in between episode 5 and 6, some extremely exciting things have happened. We have a new addition to the family.
Yes, we do.
All right, what'd you buy?
So, last Saturday, I got...
Oh, wait, hold on.
A Moto Guzzi Norgia.
I think it's pronounced Norg.
It might be Norge. I don't know. We'll play with that. Technically, it's Norgia, which is Italian for Norway.
Okay.
Fun fact.
So, this is a Moto Guzzi. This is a twin.
This is a 1200cc air-cooled transverse V-twin.
Excellent. All right, what are the numbers? What's the power on this?
It's 89 horsepower, and it is 74 foot-pounds of torque.
Okay.
Which is pretty damn good.
And it's about 500 pounds, 520?
So it's 550 pounds dry. Oh. And that is important, because this thing has a 7-gallon fuel tank. So just adding the gas alone, that brings you up to 620 pounds.
Okay. Well, you know, fortunately, it's got a good amount of torque in it to pull that along.
It does.
All right. And so how much have you ridden it so far?
So I rode it 10 miles from the dealership back home. Then we did our trip to... 3 Margaritas, which added another 20 miles. And then I just rode it 50 miles in sub-freezing temperatures. Apparently, the weather report was significantly off for north of Denver.
Right, but you reckoned it was actually sort of doable if you adjusted your gear a little bit, right?
Yeah. So I had, you know, hoodie under my jacket, which also had a rain lighter to block the wind, and my body was totally fine. You know, I've got substantial boots. My feet were fine. I really had very thin summer gloves on.
Because one of your winter gloves was here.
Yes. I'm glad that I have that. Of course, I didn't bring the other one because I didn't know it was here, so I'm still riding back in summer gloves. But I was able to ride for an hour nonstop in summer gloves thanks to the heated grips.
Ooh.
Which are pretty fancy. They don't put out a lot of heat. They're not like snowmobile heated grips. They're not insane. But they do a pretty good job and they make a big difference. Because normally, for me, if it's 40 degrees out, I can do like half an hour before I'm just like, I can't deal with this because I cannot deal with cold hands. But I rode for an hour in summer gloves in 24 to 36 degree temperatures, which is impressive for me.
Well, it's got such great wind protection and that electric adjustable windscreen too.
Yes. I always thought that was a really gimmicky thing, but now that I've tried it and messed with it, it's a really great feature. If you have a sport bike and you only ride it like an hour at a time, you don't do long trips, you can just pick a windscreen that just fits the posture that you ride with, and you're pretty much good to go. But if you're going through multiple postures and you're adjusting and you're going long distance, it can be really annoying to like have to hold a particular posture to get the right profile for the wind to go over you and take that burden away from the long distance riding. But just being able to switch position and then just hit a button and adjust the windscreen to give you the same wind protection is excellent. I love it.
Is it good enough that if you had a bike that didn't offer this, would you buy a manual adjustable windscreen to make do?
No. And the reason for that is with a manual adjustable windscreen, maybe if you use it enough, you can dial it in and just know what you need to set it to. But first of all, you generally have to stop to use those. And on top of that, if you're going to stop to mess with it, you lose the feedback of having the wind coming at you at 65 miles an hour. So you can't just adjust it on the fly and just have it there and have it be good. That's what the electric adjustment really does, is it's while you're moving, you can just take 10 seconds, hit a button on your handlebars, adjust it, and you're good to go. It's an excellent feature. It's good. I like it.
So this is a really one of the high points of the Bergman that wasn't celebrated enough.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, when we mentioned it on the Bergman, I thought it was just a silly thing, but no, it's good.
Well, it is silly that it's on the Bergman.
Well, yeah. That gives it credibility as a long distance vehicle.
Now, this is your first fuel injected bike, and mm-hmm. it's your first ABS.
Well, fortunately, I haven't I haven't tested the ABS yet, but it's nice to know that it's there, especially coming up here where, you know, it was 24 degrees and who knows what the roads were like. That was a nice little confidence boost. The fuel injection is nice, just having the engine, just knowing that it's going to rev where it's supposed to and it's
going to start.
Yeah.
In the cold.
Yeah, that's good. The storage space is amazing. The storage space, I would reckon there's probably 80 liters of storage space just in the panniers.
Yeah, because they each fit a full helmet, right?
They each fit a full helmet. I was also able to fit my backpack with my laptop in it and a bunch of stuff. Just put the whole thing straight in the pannier. You can fit a briefcase with a 15-inch laptop in it in these panniers, no problem.
I wish they were removable. That would really just set the thing off, and I would want one if they were removable. If I was riding to work or something with it, because it's a great, you know, sport tour sort of thing, and it's kind of a good commuter too. If I could put all that stuff, because there's so much luggage space.
So I have looked at it. It's I believe it's one bolt.
Yeah, but you're not going to take that and remove.
Yeah,
it.
Yeah, so you can't do it every day, but you know, next time we go down to Coda. Instead of having to like take things in and out of the panniers on the bike and go out to the bike all the time, I can just take the panniers off.
No, we're going to want to leave them for beer runs.
Oh, you got a point there.
There we go. All right. Now, what's really significant about this bike is this is our first podcast bike. We've set some ground rules here. So we are going to be living with at least one extra bike per year or season of the show, maybe two. We're going to each have our regular bikes, which are for us, my ZX6 Ninja, which we'll get back to in a minute, and your 2001 W650.
2000.
Oh, it's 2000. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, they just made it. Yeah, it doesn't matter which year. They're both identical, just the 2 years they made it here or sold it here. Anyway, so what we've got is now this nerd thing, and it's gonna be so we've set the rules as you're only allowed to insure it for 1 year. You're not allowed to renew the insurance before the insurance is up. You've got to get rid of it and buy another podcast bike, or if you keep it, you have to sell the W650.
Right.
Okay, this is exciting. Now, I've actually just recently come across something that I think I might be able to pick up in a month or so here as a second podcast bike. And it's really weird. I'm going to leave it as a surprise. But anyway, so we've got this podcast bike. So basically, over the year, we're going to be telling everyone what it's really like to live with a Moto Guzzi Noger for a full year. We're going to ride it through the summer, through the winter. It's going to go on a couple long road trips. It's going to be a daily commuter. And we're really going to get down to the nitty gritty. And maybe after a year, who knows, someone out there in podcast land might just be sold on buying one for themselves. Now, back to the ZX6E. So I bought a ZX6 Ninja for like $700 a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And had to do very little to it to get it running. Popped up on Craigslist and I was like, oh, these are so cool. I got to get one because I'm obsessed with 90s sport bikes. And it was just your regular, just needed the carb service sort of thing. Got up and running And I quickly discovered that, like a lot of 90s sport bikes, and I wasn't 100% shocked by this, second gear was gone. Not gone, it was popping into neutral. And so last year, I had the bike just completely gone through. Complete engine rebuild, everything, fixed second gear. The shift fork was chewed up a little bit and all of that. And just the day before yesterday, got it back on the road and everything. It's all been tuned up. First ride, second gear still pops into neutral. Now, I've done some more investigation, and I'm 99% sure I know what the actual problem is. So anyone out there that has a 90 sport bike, or even just like a newer 600 and second gear goes out, before you pay someone or sell it off because you think second gear is gone, and you pay someone to split the cases and redo the transmission, take your clutch basket off and replace the detent arm and or the shift star and spring. Because it turns out what they, and even the shift stars are normally pretty okay, but they put in crazy springs into all these 90s bikes that are a little too strong for the arm that holds the shift star in position. And the end of the arm is just this solid roller piece, and it creates a lot of friction on the star. Now, it typically pops second gear into neutral because there's a little dip on one of the points of the star, and that's where neutral is. That's why it's the half click in between gears. So you could buy a better arm that has like a micro roller bearing on it, which produces less friction. It doesn't get worn out or misshapen weirdly, and you're going to get your second gear back probably. Now, if you've been riding it a long time this way and you've been like trying to just force it into second, do that little trick where you just stuff your toe underneath the shifter and just hold it up into second gear and it grinds, well, you might have done some damage to your gears or your shift fork. But there is a very good chance that for like $100, you can just take your clutch off, which quite often you don't have to remove any fairing for or anything, replace this arm, and you're good to go. There's a very good chance. And that's almost certainly what's going to have to happen to the Ninja the next week here. It's an hour or two job. Keep your 90s bike on the road. They're awesome. So there we go. All right, now I've got a couple updates here as well on not our bikes, but our listeners. We got some things very wrong in the last episode. Our listener in Georgia is not from Atlanta. He is from a town about an hour away. I don't know if like our podcast info updated and it became more accurate, but the town is like Mayfield, May something. Look it up there.
Maysville?
Maysville. That's it. Now, there is a motorcycle shop in Maysville called City Slickers. So, and I've taken a look. Now, City Slickers doesn't have a website or anything. This is a small little motorcycle shop. But they seem like good people by their Facebook page. And I've looked at a couple of people that have commented on the Facebook page. And I think I've narrowed it down to one or two people that it's probably our listener. I've gone deep CSI okay. on this. So let us know which one you are. I don't feel like saying your name on the podcast. I don't think that's cool. But I think I know exactly who you are. All right. Now, also, we messed up our listener, our Kentucky listener, because we even got the fucking state wrong. They're in Illinois.
No. Oh. Yeah, I guess I just can't read.
Yeah. So it was, Belleville?
Belvedere.
Belvedere, Illinois. So I looked up the town of Belvedere, Illinois, and I'm fairly certain that Belvedere is probably going to pop up on Small Town Murder soon. But it seems like a pleasant enough little place. And I was poking around the website, and I think it's the mayor of Belvedere. I don't know. If you look at the picture of him on the website, I just feel that he's got a stock Sportster. He just looks like he does. I can't remember his name. I don't have it pulled up.
Oh, so, hey, let me pull this up.
Now, I think we've got nothing to do except get to the best worst bike in the world this week.
Yep.
Okay. Are you ready, Swiggy?
Let's go. The Ninja 650.
Wait, is this the best or worst bike?
This is the worst bike.
Okay.
Worst bike in the world.
This week.
This week. And I think I'm going to convince you here.
Okay.
So, there's a lot of problems with this bike.
All right.
Now, on paper, it's actually an excellent bike.
Yeah.
If you really look at it, it's got really good, it's got pretty good numbers. It's 72 horsepower, and it's got 48 foot-pounds of torque.
It's also cheap and reliable, so you've got a ways to go here.
I do. Now, here's really what the problem is. All this is, if you really boil down what this bike is, it is a Z650 with fairings for $400 more.
Right. That's exactly all what it is.
Mm-hmm. So what you've got here, you've got the tall standard handlebars.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the same body as the Z650. And now it's just living this lie that it's actually a super sport.
It is living a big lie.
And it's just not. Why would you not just have a Z650 instead? How many people have you talked to that said, yeah, I had a Ninja 650. It was the bomb. I loved it. Oh my God. I'm thinking about it. You know, this is a 2006 model. It's a little old. It's carbureted. I want to move up to fuel injection. I'm going to look at getting credit for a 2017, a 2018. Never happened. Never will happen. This bike.
Yeah, the Ninja 250 is more deserving of the Ninja name.
Right. So,
because at least within that class, it's, you know, a leader. And this is definitely anemic in its experience.
Right. Now, if it had similar numbers, or if it had a little more horsepower, a little less torque, but it was an inline four, I'd be more inclined to
yeah, if
to
it was like a CBR 650F, which we love so much.
But the CBR 650F is kind of, it's a little more extreme because, you know, it's not just a straight standard bike with a sport fairing on it.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually an inline four. It's a little bit more aggressive in the seating position. You've got some actual, well, not full-on clip-ons, but very similar to your ZX6.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the inline four. It sounds like a super sport.
Right.
If you heard this thing coming along, you wouldn't know what to make of it. You'd think it was like an FZ07, or you'd think it was somebody riding an SV650 with a stock muffler.
Right.
You know, it doesn't really feel like a super sport. And again, there's no excitement about this bike. Nobody's clamoring to see what the latest Ninja 650 is going to do. But, you know, there are lots of people who would be happy to pick up a Z650 or a Z900. But this bike, it's a dead end. It's a tack-on feature. And it's got nowhere to go. And for that, I have to throw it into the pool.
It's a poser is what it is. It's like if we went back to like 1997 and some kid got his hands on a Phish record, and then all of a sudden he just started going to shows and pretending he knew everything about the band. This is, you know, he's just an overnight like Phish fan hippie kid, right?
Right.
And this bike is like that in that it was just walking around one day as the Z650 basically, or whatever. And then it went, oh, wait a minute. I'm just going to dress differently and pretend I can hang out with the cool kids. And it can't. And it's very quickly exposed for what it really is.
Right. Now, if your first bike was a Ninja 650, I can understand. If you found one on Craigslist for $2,000 to $3,000 and it was your first bike, I'm sure you had a blast. I'm sure it was a lot of fun and it opened up a whole new world to you. But I'm guessing you moved on within 18 months and decided you needed something else. Nobody's hanging on to this bike.
Right. Now, it serves a purpose in the used market, like you just mentioned, as, you know, cheap, cheerful, reliable first bike. And, you know, and there's plenty of bikes that aren't necessarily excellent, but fill that role excellently. This does as a used bike. I'm thinking what you're really getting at is there's not a very compelling reason to buy one new when there are better styled, cooler, cheaper options out there. And maybe even not much cheaper, but a little bit, and they're not living a lie.
Right, because, you know, you see this on the showroom floor and you think, oh my god, look at this Super Sport, it's so cool. But then once you just scratch at the surface, it's, oh, this is something that really started as a naked bike and turned into a sport bike because they could just tack on the fairings.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, non-motorcycle people will think you've got a super fast crotch rocket, but you don't.
Yeah, so...
And deep down, you'll know that. And right. That's what's most important. You have to feel good on the bike. You have to feel cool. You know, why are you going to ride a bike if you don't feel cool?
So, to tell you how uninspiring this bike really is, Kawasaki doesn't even really like this bike. And the only reason it's being produced is because the Z650 is actually a great bike. And, you know, all we have to do is tack fairings onto it. So why don't we just keep making it? Apparently people are buying it.
Well, and like you just said, it is a Z650. So it's really just the lie that it's adding. It's taken a great bike and it's made it in... It's corrupted the Z650.
Right. So, to give you an idea of how much Kawasaki is ashamed of this bike, they list the engine as an 8-valve 4-stroke. They don't even tell you that it's a 2-cylinder motor in it.
They're trying to lie to you about the engine.
Yeah.
Oh, that's just that. Oh, that's.
Yeah.
That's disappointing, Kawasaki. That's really disappointing.
And for those reasons, it is the worst bike in the world this week.
Kawasaki Heavy Industry? More like Kawasaki Heavy Liars. Okay. All right. So now for the best bike in the world this week. This is going to be crazy controversial. The Honda NM4. This is the Batmobile bike. So this was originally a concept bike that didn't annoy us. This came up in 2014 as the Voltus or NM4 Voltus. Now, this ties into a couple of the bikes that we've already featured on Best Worst Bike in the World. So we trashed on in episode 2 the Honda DeVille, right? So when Honda got rid of that line, the NV line, they replaced it with this new platform, the NC line, right? So you get the NC700X and all those, whatever. This is an NC700.
Okay, I see it now.
Right. So Kawasaki, Honda made this crazy concept bike, and then they realized, wait a minute, we can just use the new NC700 platform and we can actually make it really cheaply. We don't have to make a lot of them. We can just sort of put this concept out this way. The original concept had a 750 motor in it, and it was a twin.
It started off as a 650 and then moved to a 750 when they brought the NC up to the 700 and the 750.
Well, it's 680 cc's is the NC700. So this is the 680 cc. So it's making the 51 horsepower and like 40 foot pounds of torque and all that the NC700 has, which, you know, now the version of the NC700 that's all like touring and everything like that that replaced the DeVille is still awful. But the NC700 has found this great home as basically the most practical, best value, reliable commuter bike. And this fills a great role as a commuter bike as well. But is it better than an NC700? No, not at all. But here's its party trick. You already know about it. It's crazy, crazy looks, right? It's not a cruiser, but it's a little bit cruiser-esque, but it's anime. You know, this is the motorcycle for, you know, a gamer. This is the motorcycle for someone who's not a motorcycle person, but yet it's actually a good bike. It's very easy to ride. It's got competent power as a commuter and all that. It's not really great on the highway or anything like that. But if you're sort of easing yourself into motorcycles, this is great. All your friends are going to think it's wild and wonderful and all of that. And what this does is this fills a big role in someone's life, because we've really been talking about, well, these bikes need to fill a role in your life. This fills a role as the bike that gets someone into bikes that never imagined they were going to be, mm-hmm. right? This doesn't strike a chord with a lot of people, but for the people that do want it and buy it, they fall in love with it. Not necessarily for a huge amount of time, but this is a hardcore gateway drug for some people. And this is really what the industry needs to do more of right now, which is make a bunch of these really crazy variants of standard platforms. You know, sort of like, you know, the Harley Roadster, right? It's a Sportster 1200, but they've dressed it up and made it a little different. And now all of a sudden a person like me that didn't think they would look at buying a Harley is like, ooh, I could use one of those, right? Mm-hmm. This is what the industry needs to be doing. And this is the most bold out there example of it. And this is what everyone needs to pay attention to, because everyone thought, oh, the NM4, whatever, that crazy thing, it's going to be around bike shows for a year or two. But hey, it's 4 years on now and they're still making it and selling them and people are buying them. Honda needs to do more of this. All the manufacturers need to do more of this. It's no coincidence that that 1 year later, Suzuki made a concept very, very similar.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point there, because, you know, if it's based on the NC700 platform, what have they really had to make to actually extend that to make this model of bike?
It's really just a different shaped airbox piece on the front, because, it's, you know, it's the Honda Fit or half of the Honda Fit engine. It's all flat. They've made these weird custom bags for the back, which are comically small. You can't fit jack shit in there. Like, it holds a couple books, and like, that's it. But I think it does have the space underneath the airbox, mm-hmm. or where the airbox would normally be to put, you know, a helmet or whatever. I think it's got that stuff like the NC700 has. But again, its party trick is the crazy styling, that weird front fairing. That's all they've had to do is just mold up a bunch of plastic to throw on it and put some different handlebars and seats. And they make this thing pretty cheaply. It's got all the options that you can get on the NC700 series. So you can get this as a, actually, I think this might just be a dual clutch only bike. But again, that makes it really easy to ride and attracts new riders. It's got a linked braking system. So I think I'm not even sure if it has a handle for the front brake. It may just be a foot pedal and a linked braking system there. It has just a really low center of gravity because of that Honda Fit engine that basically sits as a flat twin, and your seat's really low. It's very, very unintimidating to ride, which is what the industry needs. This doesn't pretend to be super fast. This doesn't pretend to be a cross-country tour, so you can forgive the small bags. It doesn't do anything except attract a very different audience, which is what so many people say that they want happening in the industry. But yet people trash this bike for looking too outlandish. If anything, it doesn't look outlandish enough. No, it looks the perfect amount of outlandish is what it looks. I take that back. And that's why it's the best bike in the world, because we need more of these crazy things to stir the pot, right?
Yeah, I mean, especially in terms of, like, when you look at this again, like, Honda didn't have to do a lot to make this. They had to, what, set up a few more molds for plastics.
Mm-hmm.
They had to make a different seat. He's got like a backrest there, which is weird and kind of cool. I don't know if I'd go for that, but, you know, there's lots of people who would. But it seems like they've done minimal work to create a wildly different thing
that can
be that gateway drug to getting somebody new into riding. And maybe they get on it and they think, oh, they bought it because they thought it was really cool and it seemed unintimidating.
Right.
And then now all of a sudden they're like, well, now I've got my permit. I've just gone and got my full license. I've ridden a few thousand miles. I'm going to try out my friend's CBR.
Right. Now, here's a great thing. Because it's about attracting new riders and it's a new bike, this is actually not a bad buy new. Now, it's $10,000. So it costs like $2,000 more than the NC700, but here's the thing. These hold value for some weird reason. Down at our favorite motorcycle shop, where things are routinely $500 to $1,000 below average for their used bikes that they're selling, there's like one of these 2 years old that's got an $8,000 price tag on it with like 10,000 miles. So it's not a bad buy new because it's the look is so specialty and so weird. And when that certain buyer that wants it comes across it, they will buy it and they'll pay whatever for it. And, you know, the NC700 has already proved itself to be ridiculously reliable. You know, it's a good bike and it looks good. I mean, it's all matte black and everything and there aren't any color options. But again, it really fits the specialty look it goes for. Like you said in a past episode, some bikes nail their own aesthetic so hard, even if it's not your thing, you have to agree with it. And this is the definition of that. Not only that, think about this. Most people dislike this bike because they think about like, oh, I'd have to be an NM4 guy to have this. Well, no, this is meant to be that weird thing that connects with a certain small percentage of people that, you know, may or may not be on the border of buying a bike. Like, I don't know. And then they see this and they go, oh, I got to have it, right? Think about if someone who's a new rider right now, 10, 15, 20, 40 years from now, they're still into bikes and someone goes, what was your first bike? And they'll get a weird grin on their face and they'll go, I had a Honda NM4. And people go, whoa, those were so weird. It's, you know, you buy this because it's going to get you into it and it's going to be a great story later on. And you'll get to go, you know what? Those bikes were actually really fun to ride and scoot around on. It was practical. It was fuel efficient. It got me into riding. And there you go. This is what the industry needs more of. We've proven that we can make bikes with unusable power, with more performance than 99% of people are ever going to be able
to utilize.
What we need is these just bikes with huge character right now.
Right.
So many classes of bikes and all these manufacturers have all these models, you know, everyone's got a little mid-size V twin, like the Suzuki, the SV650, right?
Mm-hmm.
Every manufacturer's got a version of that. Every manufacturer's got an inline four super bike. Everyone's got all this stuff that's sort of blah all the same. And it really only comes down to what brand you're buying. This doesn't fit into that. This breaks the mold and speaks to very different people. And it does it in a very unique way. And we need more of them. We need more bikes that speak in a very unique way. And that's why this is the best bike in the world this week. Because it's inspiring.
I agree. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, if you go read any online articles about, you know, the 2018 GSXR, or you're going to have the GSXR 600 2018 models, and some journalist is going to ride both of them and he's going to pick apart every little piece of it and look at where the peak horsepower is, where the peak torque is, what's the peak torque for each one, what's the peak horsepower, what's the cost, what's the suspension like, and treat the consumer suspension like it's track, supposed to be track suspension. And he's going to decide, oh, the Ninja, it's way better. Like, you, there's no reason you should ever buy a GSX R600. But in reality, if you got on both of those bikes, they're 98% the same thing. They're class bikes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you put either one in the hands of your average rider, they'll be able to wring the same performance out of them. They're pretty close in price. But when you make something like this, it's like, well, what are you going to compare this to? You can't. You have to just ride it, experience it, and judge it on its own merits. And I applaud Honda for that, and I agree. Best bike in the world.
All right, cool. Let's take a little break here. Rolling again. All right, so what are we talking about now?
All right, so Harley-Davidson has just announced that they are going to have an electric motorcycle in production within 18 months.
Okay, now, they did an electric bike before, Project Livewire.
So in 2014, they did the Livewire project, which at the time was fairly respectable, considering that it was a concept bike that they rolled around and a lot of people tried out. It was making 70-ish horsepower and 50-something foot-pounds of torque,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty respectable for an electric bike.
It had pretty short range, like 80 miles or something.
It was 55 miles.
Ooh.
So not very good. But again, this was their first stab at an electric bike. It was still under 500 pounds. So it was fairly light for a large electric bike.
Also, it had like a naked sports bike look to it, which is a big departure for Harley-Davidson.
Yeah, it was very different from what they normally produced. So I have a few things to say about this. Well, one is, you know, Harley-Davidson's not doing so well.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's not really doing all that well, but Harley in particular, you know, as an American manufacturer who's also getting their market share eaten up by Indian.
Right.
So I feel like this is actually an excellent move for Harley. Mainly because, you know, they need to reach a younger audience.
Mm-hmm.
They need to, in order to do that, they need to address their image problem that, you know, millennials in general just do not like Harley-Davidson. They don't really like the biker culture, and they don't really like the poser dentists either.
Right.
Which is a big problem. Now, by going electric, what I think this really does for them is, A, it's somewhat eco-friendly, it's okay. futuristic, and building an electric bike is, in a lot of ways, a lot simpler than something with an internal combustion engine. Because you just need a beefy final drive, you pick an electric motor, and then you choose how many and where you're going to put the battery cells.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything else is identical. So you can make some minor tweaks, up the battery capacity, or shuffle some stuff around. And it's actually a really simple system to modify. And then very quickly, you can just have a whole range of bikes that are very similar. You don't have to make multiple fuel tanks. You don't have to have tons of different configurations for motors. You just pick a couple motors, you get some different battery sizes, and you just kind of slap it all together, and as long as it's balanced and it will perform well, you know, it's pretty easy to slap together a whole new lineup that will appeal to a lot of younger riders, which is what they need to do.
Right. So, do we have any pictures of this thing yet? Anything at all?
There's no information on this. There's just the announcement. So it could be very similar to the Livewire, just with updated battery technology and a new motor. you know, mainly profiting off the work that everybody else has done. Because, you know, a lot of those companies aren't making their own electric motors. You know, it's probably going to be not an in-house thing. They're just going to go buy a bunch of parts from a bunch of different companies and slap it together.
Now, I've purposely, you know, since this was announced, not looked up anything on it, 'cause I just want to kind of be surprised a little bit. But why do they seem to be so secretive about it right now?
I don't think they're trying to be secretive about it. I think they've just decided this is what we're going to do, looking at last quarter's performance numbers, and say, we're going to announce this now. And I think they announced it because the sales were so bad and, you know, their evaluation was dropping so quickly. They needed to get something out and just say, this is what we're going to do. And they just put it out there. I think it speaks more to how badly the company is doing right now, considering they just closed a plant.
Yeah.
And then they killed off close to 300 jobs at another plant, which I think is in response to saying, all right, well, we need to change things up. We actually have more bikes than we can sell because the sales are dropping so quickly.
Right, and they didn't have a Buell they could just cut off either.
Yeah. You know, it is kind of sweet that now that their primary market is dying off, they're finally getting bitten by not having Buell anymore.
Yeah, in your face. Okay, so they've decided to do this electric bike. Are they just going to completely abandon their traditional buyers?
I don't think so. I think they're still going to produce those bikes, but, you know, they don't have to produce as many of them anymore because, you know, they're dying off and they're not buying them as much.
Do you think this bike, this new electric bike from them, is going to throw a bone to their old customers at all?
I think it will. Well,
you know, will it be a cruiser or will it be another sort of, you know, zero-ish looking sort of bike?
What I think it's going to be is, I think it's going to be a very safe, broad market approach to start with. And it's going to be the one model to start with. And they're going to see what it does. And it's going to get a ton of attention and exposure because, oh my God, Harley's making an electric bike. What is this? What's going to happen? You know, because, you know, this is something that like CNN is reporting on because it's Harley Davidson. It's, you know, it is the biggest American brand. So I think it's going to be a very safe, milquetoast, middle of the road standard bike for the first year. And it's going to do well just because it's a Harley and, oh my God, Harley's making an electric bike. And I think once that's occurred, I think immediately the year after, you're going to see something bigger, maybe with some more updated styling, but it's going to start, you're going to get something that starts to look like a Sportster or a Road King or an Electric Glide. You're going to get something like that because, let's be real, most Harley riders don't go on long trips. They go out when it's perfect weather on the weekend and they'll still put their 1,000 miles in. They'll charge the bike up 10 times in a year, which they can do at home, and that'll be it. So I think they will go that. I don't think they'll do that right away, but I think they're going to do it very quickly after, if the first bike is somewhat of a success.
Yeah, it's just, you know, for a cruiser, you got to have range, and it doesn't matter if you ride it a lot or not. It's got to have that range or it's not really, you know, a cruiser and no one's going to buy it.
Well, here's the thing. An electric motor is a lot smaller than an internal combustion engine.
Uh-huh.
The main issue is that you have to have a ton more batteries on it.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, there's just no way you're ever going to get the amount of energy per mass of gasoline. It'll just never happen. But if the bike is meant to be big and heavy, and you don't really have to scale up the electric motor that much. And you're talking about a bike that normally weighs 800 to 900 pounds. All of a sudden, you start replacing a lot of the metal with plastics, and then, oh, we can fit 300 pounds of battery on this bike, no problem, and have a similar profile and a similar feel to it, just you don't have the motor and you don't have the sound.
Yeah.
But then you also get to say, when you take this back to the dealer, if there's an issue, it's a one-day fix. You know, plug the computer into a tool, we read off what's wrong with it, and, oh, we got to swap out a bad cell. Or, oh, we got to, you know, your motor's burned out, but it's under warranty, we'll replace that. It's not like, oh, well, yeah, one of the valves isn't seating properly, we got to take the top end off, I'm going to dismantle most of the bike to get to that. And then we got to order some parts, or, you know, because your bike's 5 years old, or, you know, you've cut out all of this because the diagnostic is plug the computer in. Let's see what it says. So it could offer a lot of advantages. And I think it'll go that way eventually.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Do you think realistically Harley could steal market share from Zero?
I think they absolutely could, and I think they could do so with a vastly inferior product, because they're Harley Davidson, and everyone's going to talk saying, holy shit, Harley's making an electric bike, what's going on? I don't understand the world anymore, you know?
They've got resources to throw behind it. It could be very good. Well, there's
that. If they're repulsed by the idea of an electric bike, is going to see one on every showroom floor. I think just through the infrastructure, you know, the dealer network, the manufacturing capacity, I think they could act. I think there is a distinct possibility that with an inferior bike, they could put Zero out of business.
That's interesting. It's scary because I love Zero.
It is.
But, you know, if they've made a commitment towards the future, you know, and that's it, and they can manage to sell them, I mean, you know, can't fault them there.
I still think the best case scenario here is it's a massive flop. They back out of it, and then they give Eric Buell another shot.
Yeah,
there we go. That's the winning scenario. But, you know, hats off to him for mixing things up and addressing the problem and recognizing it and saying, okay, we can't keep doing this anymore. We've got to get with the times. So I applaud them for that.
Do you know what Eric Buell's doing right now?
No.
I wonder if he's secretly involved in this, like, already. If Harley's just like, man, we need an out-of-the-box thinker. Like, man, if only we had one of those around. And, you know, maybe some guy at the back of the room, like, slowly raised his hand. You know, like, am I going to get fired for suggesting we call Eric? Right?
And Eric's just like, all right. The swing arm is made of batteries.
Right, yeah, yeah. Forget fuel and frame, battery and frame, right? Yes. Yeah. So Eric was probably just like sitting outside the window, you know, with like a stethoscope on the glass, just trying to hear what they were doing. And when someone said like, oh, is Eric around anywhere? He just jumped through the door. Oh, hey, guys.
Yes.
I need a job. What's going on? All right. Well, good for Harley. I mean, you know, honestly, good for Harley. Like, I like that they're doing this.
So I do have one thing to say here.
Okay.
And this is, you know, Harley riders get a really bad rep and somewhat of a deserved reputation for, you know, just bad-mouthing other bikes, other manufacturers, riding different styles of bikes, even shitting on Sportsters and Street 500s.
Right.
But there is a certain crowd in the rest of the bike market who are total Debbie Downers, who are totally shitting on Harley for making this move. And I don't really get it, because I understand Harley riders, you know, talking about heritage and classic styling and never wanting to give up the motors they have now. But if you've been shitting on Harley, and there's lots of good reasons to shit on Harley, and I'm sure we're going to have our turn pretty soon, if you're whining about Harley switching the game up at this point, and you're saying they should be doing something else, you know, to save their failing business, where do you actually expect them to go? Is there any scenario in which Harley could possibly redeem themselves in your eyes? Or are you just a miserable bastard?
They're a miserable bastard. Well, so Harley is...
I guess what I'm really saying is just sort your life out, okay?
Right. Well, here's part of the genius of Harley Davidson, right? They are the be-all and end-all to their loyal fan base. But then, in a very Jorge Lorenzo sort of way, they are this villain to everyone else.
Right.
And everyone, and to everyone else, they're this villain that, you know, they love hating, right? Anti-Harley people are just as passionate as Harley people. You know, that's why it's such a strong brand, or it's such a strong, you know, it's such a strong brand because of that
right.
interaction. So a lot of people are satisfied by loving Harley, and a lot of people are satisfied by hating Harley, right?
Right.
They see it as, you know, this symbol that's akin to like the Confederate flag or something, right? They, they put that sort of emotion into it. That's not what it is at all. But I think Harley's aware of it, and they play to that a little bit. And it's one of those things that's kept their fan base so loyal mm-hmm. because Harley is always on brand. And when Harley does a move like this, people lose their mind. There's cognitive dissonance, and they don't know how to interpret it. So I get people being confused by it. And when people are confused, they're always a little bit scared. And what do people do to things that they're scared of? They hate them, right?
Right.
They lash out at it to things they don't understand and things they hate and things that scare them. So, okay, yeah, it might be scary that someone with the resources that Harley Davidson has will go up and compete against a company that we've come to really appreciate, like Zero. Even though, you know, Zero's not setting the world on fire with sales, I think most people recognize what they're doing is really cool and progressive, and there's a lot of value to it, even if you're not an electric bike person or don't out there doing that thing.
Right.
And in a lot of ways, they're a symbol of anti-Harley, right? Even though I don't think Zero looks at themselves that way at all. So, yeah. You know, haters gonna hate. It's the internet, right? And, you know, we're talking electric bikes and no one knows what's gonna happen. You're gonna get stupid idiots that can't sort their life out and want to just keep hating Harley no matter what. I say good for him, though.
Yeah, me too.
All right. So also in electric bike news.
Well, I do want to preface this next segment a little bit, because on the 3rd of February, SpaceX made history by launching the world's largest rocket, the world's largest reusable rocket, no less, into space and put a Tesla into space on course to do a flyby of Mars. Unfortunately, they picked the wrong day and got shown up when MotoGP revealed the Moto E class of Grand Prix racing.
I'm pretty excited about this. A lot of people are not, but these bikes look amazingly cool.
They are super cool. So the bike is being, the title sponsor is Enel, and the manufacturer is an Italian company called Energica.
Uh-huh.
And the bike is actually based on a production model of the bikes that they make. I believe it's the Ego it's kind of based off of, which is a full-on super sport style electric bike. So these are pretty serious bikes, and they retail right now. Like, the base model is basically on par with a Goldwing.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're like $24,000 base model. So the bikes have 147 horsepower,
mm-hmm.
147 foot-pounds of torque.
Cool.
I believe it does fall off as the RPMs go up, so it's like up to 5,000 RPMs of the motor, is where it starts to drop below 147 foot-pounds of torque. But absolute ridiculous unusable power in Grand Prix racing. Yeah, and the bikes look fantastic.
With all that torque, they're going to be faster in all the twisty sections and a little bit slower on the back straights then.
Right. Well, here's the thing. Like, I don't even know what's going to happen off the starting line. When what technology, if they have like anti-wheel spin or something, I imagine they don't want to add that in because part of the skill is going to be applying as much power as possible without getting the rear wheel spin.
Yeah, it's true.
So who knows what's going to happen the first time all of these riders line up and do a real race for the first time and pull off the starting line. What's going to happen? Is it going to be like absolutely ridiculous disparate levels of skill? Are we gonna see just absolute carnage? Because they're gonna knock the socks off of even the MotoGP class because they're using the same tires. It'll be interesting.
I think is gonna happen, because we know that satellite riders and teams in MotoGP are going to get these bikes, and Moto2 teams are going to get these bikes.
So let's go through a little bit more of the information.
Hold on. I hope that Jack Miller's going to get one of these.
Yes.
And in one of the first few turns, because the bikes are quiet, we're going to be able to hear him telling another rider to fuck off in the middle of a corner.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So, to follow on with that point. So, there's going to be 18 bikes total on the grid. There's going to be for 10 races.
Okay.
Now, all seven of the independent teams in the MotoGP class will each get two bikes.
So that includes Jack Miller.
Yes.
Excellent.
Well, not necessarily, because for the Moto E class, I'm kind of skeptical that a lot of the semi-competitive riders will get it, because the satellite teams are getting the bikes, but they don't have to put their MotoGP rider on the bike. So it may be that they pick up a bunch of Moto2 riders to do it, or it may be that they pick people up who are outside of MotoGP altogether to ride them. We may also see like test riders going into the end of the class. We may see people completely outside the current competition riding them, but we may see some of the back... They're
going to have to put, at least every team's going to have to put one of their GP riders, and certainly their most popular GP rider, in it, because they want it to get attention, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know who Pramac Ducati's test rider is. I know who Jack Miller is, right? Now, I'm going to go and see it. I'm going to watch it just because I want to see the electric bikes race. But I'm sure that Dorna wants name recognition on the grid.
Well, I'm sure they do, but I'm also pretty sure that the teams don't want to have their riders splitting their time on a completely different bike in season.
Well, yeah, but how big of a time commitment really is it? Because there's no prestige behind this title yet.
Right.
I mean, there will be some prestige to winning the very first one. But, you know, someone's going to emerge as being the best to ride this kind of bike pretty quickly. And then, you know, someone else is going to figure out some new stuff. And then the top riders will come and go very quickly for a few years, I imagine, until it's sort of the style you need to ride these stabilizes. Mm-hmm. And then you'll get some like big long term champions and some aliens within the class. But to begin with, Dorna just wants people watching this.
Right. So
they're fronting all the money to make it happen. The teams aren't even really paying for it.
Right. And so, but that's where I'm wondering, are teams going to let their top riders split their time between this? I find it hard to believe that they will, but if they do, that's going to be awesome.
Well, a factory team wouldn't do it. But, you know, if you're like, well, I don't know, how much camera time is Cal Crutchlow really going to get this weekend?
Right.
Well, if we put him on a bike with all of our sponsors in the Moto E class, probably a lot more than he would get hanging around in ninth place during the race, which he's going to be at anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, maybe he'll be in 10th place, but he could be leading the Moto E class. You know, they're going to want to get that sponsorship, you know, stickers on the side of the bikes out there and on the screen. Mm-hmm. So they're going to have to put the GP riders on these bikes.
Well, we'll see what happens. Also, additionally, there are four other bikes, because there's the seven satellite teams, each getting two. The remaining four bikes will be going to, I don't know if there's a bidding process or if Dorna's selecting them, but to at least to two teams that can be either Moto2 or Moto3 teams will each get a couple riders on these bikes. So again, who knows? Maybe it's people who are competing. Maybe it's kind of the journeymen who've been in the class for a long time and don't see a way up. Maybe they can just say, all right, here's the deal, Luthy. You're not MotoGP material, but check out this electric bike. Go have fun in this class. Maybe it's just another form of nepotism. And so they can just be like, well, we've got this new guy coming along. You know, we're grooming him. So here's an easy way to get Luthy off the bike.
Right.
So we can fit another rider in, but we don't have to cancel his contract. We're just going to say, you're the Moto E rider now. Who knows?
Well, they're only doing six of these races, right?
I believe they were doing 10 races.
Oh.
They're doing quite a few. Oh, I can't remember if it's 5 or 10. But yeah, it's not a full season. It's, you know, they're starting it.
This is more or less just an exhibition.
Right. For now, that's what it is. It's really just an exhibition. Now, the races themselves are only going to be 10 laps, which, yeah, you know, is limited by the charge. And I think they're only having one free practice and one qualifying period.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're pretty short and it's limited by the charge, which is understandable. But here's the interesting thing. They said up front that they will never increase the number of laps as the technology improves. They're just going to put all of the advances into making the race faster and more exciting. So it's always going to be 10 laps. Even if they solve, you know, even if battery technology goes crazy, and all of a sudden we can fit three times the charge in the same weight, they're saying, no, it's always going to be 10 laps. Which I think is a combination of, one, just saying, hey, this is just going to get faster and faster and faster. But I think it's also a calendar thing where it's like, well, we've got to fit an extra race in on Sunday, so we can't have this being a full-length race, and so they're just going to have it always be 10 laps. Now, I do have a bit of an issue with that, in that they're saying they're doing this to, you know, to be more eco-friendly and to really push electric vehicles as the future, because, you know, we're adding so many vehicles onto the road, we can't just all keep buying gas guzzlers, we've got to find a way to lower emissions, right. So we're going to push electric bikes. But the number one thing that people have against buying electric vehicles, you know, is basically just fuel anxiety and range anxiety. And now you've just said, we're never going to make this race any longer than it is.
Like, oh, yeah. So you're not addressing people's main concern and trying to make it more popular.
Yeah. Which is weird to me. I don't know why they're going that way.
Yeah. Well, I think they probably would once it can attain MotoGP speed. Once these bikes can easily do 220 miles an hour, then they might add more range.
Mm-hmm.
But no one's going to really fully accept it unless they can understand that it's superior to MotoGP in some way. And mm-hmm. the easiest, you know, metric that your average fan is going to understand is speed.
Yeah, that's true.
And also, you know, this is Dorna. Like, weird rules come and go. I think if the class is popular enough, if people are really into it, then they'll drop Moto 3 or something and make it Moto E. Mm-hmm. Or they'll just call Moto E Moto 3 or 3E or whatever. They can do whatever they want, you know?
That's an interesting proposition. If they just swapped it out.
Yeah.
That'd make me very sad, though. I love the Moto 3 bike so much.
I do, too. But what if you said, okay, there instead of a 250 single, it's an electric bike that has the same top speed as a Moto 3 bike. You're still racing small bikes, and you have all the benefits of racing those small bikes. Now, it's a little bit tragic in that I think the Moto 3 bikes sound the coolest.
Yeah.
But that class isn't held as sacred as other classes. So if you still have the concept of small engine racing just with electric bikes, I think there's a way to do that.
So,
and it'd be much more realistic to get in the full number of laps if you're detuning the motors a little bit to only match Moto 3 bikes in speed versus Moto GP bikes.
Right. So now the other interesting thing about this is that they're still using the Michelin tires. Now, when you've got an electric motor that isn't relying on, you know, the power stroke from each cylinder,
mm-hmm.
you've got perfectly continuous power delivery. That's going to really affect the wear on the tires. So if Michelin is gathering up all these tires after each race and studying them, they may find some interesting data, and it may turn into some actual useful information for the MotoGP class. There may be something that they discover when you remove... Because, you know, what you basically got here is a control for the firing order on the motors.
Yeah.
So now that you can have, you know, world-class riders competing on these tires with continuous power delivery, it may reveal some information about what they can do to make the tires even better. And it could potentially lead to some really big innovations in the tire technology we have, which is the most limiting factor in spec racing.
I wonder if the tires aren't really up to the task right now for the electric bikes because of the huge torque, and that's the reason for the 10 lap limit.
Oh, you think they're just getting shredded because they're just putting so much torque on them?
Yeah. I mean, you know, they could make a tire already that a MotoGP bike can essentially not even come close to destroying for an entire 25 laps. You know, they could make perfect tires for Formula One. They intentionally make them so they will drop off because it makes the racing more fun to watch.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, does this need to get more popular so the tire manufacturers will create special tires for it, but they're not going to yet? And they've probably figured out, well, 10 laps is a good number right now. Because what's the distance of 10 laps? What, like 20-something miles?
It's going to be around there, yeah.
Yeah, these bikes can do more than that in range, right?
Well, it depends, because, you know, I think the bikes, they were saying that the max power output was something like 30 kilowatts or something crazy like that. And
mm-hmm.
Or 25 kilowatts, and the bikes could hold a maximum. They got a modular battery design. So they could hold 5 kilowatt hours of power, or they could hold up to 50.
Right.
Which works out to, with the maximum amount of batteries on the bike and the maximum weight, you could basically hold the whole thing like wide open throttle for half an hour, which is quite a lot. But I imagine they're going to have to start making decisions in terms of how much battery capacity they're going to put on each bike, and are we going to see people run out of charge before they cross the finish line? But also, you know, once you lower that, you're getting into territory where you risk, you know, just running out of power. So who knows? I mean, maybe the bikes can do like 120 miles fully charged, but when you're going wide open throttle and you're bringing it up to 150 miles an hour, how long can it sustain 150 miles an hour? Probably around 50 miles.
Right, but right now the races are 20 miles, more or less. I mean, your average GP course is what, 1.7 to 2.2 miles? That's about the range.
That'll depend on how much battery capacity you put in the bikes, because that adds a lot of weight to, like, for example, the Livewire probably had around 7 kilowatt hours. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of the, like, the base model Zeros have, like, 6 or 7 kilowatt hours. So it'll be interesting to see. I may be completely wrong on that. Well, we'll find out in post.
Yeah. Okay. Moto E. I'm excited. All right. We got any more topics?
Yeah, we do have one. We finally have an American in MotoGP again.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
We got Joe Roberts is joining Moto2.
So, he's taking over for Yanni Hernandez, right? What's mm-hmm. the team again?
AGR.
And they had to drop out of last season?
Yeah, they dropped out of last season. They didn't even compete in the last four races. So now, they were very happy with his performance. So he came in, you know, kind of mid-season and took over a few races. His very first race in Moto2, first race on a Moto2 bike, is in the Czech Republic at Brno. And he came 10th in a wet race in his first Moto2 race.
That's pretty promising. I think everyone's going to go nuts at COTA when this guy hits the track.
Yeah, so, you know,
because we haven't had an American on for a few years since Nicky Hayden's last GP races.
Yeah. So Austin has always been, it hasn't been actually, it's just been, it's grown really quickly and it's super popular, but it's grown without an American to root for.
Now we have it.
And if he keeps being successful, maybe, just maybe, this may spawn a whole bunch of new riders. You know, I'm sure we're going to have a bunch of riders coming up because of Nicky Hayden. And this might continue it if he can move up into the MotoGP class. Maybe he's here for a couple of years in Moto2. But, you know, I'm excited for the fact that when we go down to COTA in a couple months, we're going to have an American to root for.
All right. Let's take a little... All right, so let's get back to what something we were talking about earlier, Harley Davidson getting bitten in the ass now that they don't have Buell, right?
Right.
So we've got this theory that this is the perfect time and really the last chance Buell could ever have, right?
Right.
So I think it's the perfect time because Harley still owns the Buell name.
Mm-hmm.
EBR is gone. EBR is, they've burned their dealer network twice, right?
Yeah.
They've been liquidated, all this sort of stuff. I don't think the investors or anyone owns anything from that anymore. They've just sold it all off completely. So the only person that still owns anything Buell or EBR related is Harley Davidson. So they're uniquely poised since they already have like the strongest dealership network ever. They could bring this back. If they really want to change their image and appeal to different riders, this is a perfect brand, especially in an age where everyone's really excited about bringing back old brands. BSA is coming back, right? Or has come back in some sort of capacity, I think.
I didn't hear about that, but that's kind of cool.
I mean, it's very boutique and small, sort of like Norton. Right. You know, Norton's back in a way. It's kind of like that, I think. No,
they are, but they aren't.
Like, exactly. It's not really. I think BSA is going to be like that. And, you know, of course, Indian. Everyone's been talking about Indian nonstop. You know, Triumph has done it for, you know, decades now, been back in a really successful way. People get nostalgic about things so quickly. I think bringing Buell back could be an event like that. And, you know, everyone really has a genuine love for the name, for the brand. And I think it would really be peace offering from Harley to everyone else to say, okay, we're going to do this thing again.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause they were great bikes. Everyone loved them. But you've thought some more about this and made some notes on it.
Right. So I have a detailed plan of what Harley should do with Buell.
Okay.
First of all, they need to just straight up bring Eric Buell back.
Yes.
Now,
they need to go pretty hardcore on this if they're really going to make it work. And they also want to do it in a cost-efficient way to really integrate it with the current bikes. Mm-hmm. So something you mentioned before was the Sportster 883 engine is 30 years old this year. If you look at the numbers, it's really not that good, especially if it's going to be, you know, their high-performance engine.
Yeah, it's just Harley's most reliable engine, and that's really it.
So here's what you do. You bring back Eric Buell.
Mm-hmm.
You drop the Sportster 883 to a 799 or a 798.
Mm-hmm.
And you drop the 1200 to an 1199 or an 1198.
Mm-hmm.
And you make the Sportster 883 and the 1200 use a high-performance motor that you also put into a Ducati-style super sport and superbike designed by Eric Buell.
Right, essentially an 1190 RX.
Right. Then what you do is you make your street-modeled sports bikes. Mm-hmm. You bring back the Surlyn plastic with the bacon, with a dye-in mold.
Right.
And you make some really practical bikes.
Mm-hmm.
And now you get those bikes into AMA, World Superbike, and World Supersport so that we can finally have a true American Ducati where you're not really playing by the same rules as the big four, but you're competing and you've got some actual racing on the line. So you bring it all together. And, you know, with Ducati, you know, Ducati doesn't have to actually be successful at racing to be successful selling bikes.
Right.
But you can really put this American touch on it where all the street models have the Surlyn plastic where it's, oh, I crashed my bike. I'll just buff out all these scratches because it's dye-in mold plastic and the colors all the way through. You've got this kind of rugged, robust, very American style and have a real American identity in a super sport and a super bike.
Yeah, and you know what else? It ties in with their philosophy, well, some of their fans' philosophy anyway. If you think about the big racing rivalry between Ford and Ferrari in the 60s, right? If Harley was started racing with Buell, or is Buell Harley Racing, or Harley Davidson Racing with Buell Bikes, and they could sort of create this straw man out of, you know, Aprilia, Moto Guzzi, not Moto Guzzi, Ducati, and all these guys. And they could actually have this our bikes against their bike mentality and have it be justified because it's a racing rivalry.
Right. Well, here's the other thing. If you have a bike that can do, that can get comparable performance to a lot of the Ducatis,
mm-hmm.
you can still target a much lower price point. And you can do, you can have things like the Surlyn plastic where it's a lot cheaper to make. It's dye and mold. It lasts longer. It's not, you know, $5,000 fairings on a Panigale. You can have, you know, you can have the Dodge Viper of motorcycles.
Right. You can make the working man's super sport.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and they, Harley has tried like weird bikes like this in the past, but it's never taken off because it's too still closely tied to their cruiser base, you know, heritage, whatever.
Right.
But the Buell name gave them and would give them again this license to do whatever the hell they wanted.
Right. And so they ditched Buell when they were doing well, and they thought, this segment isn't really doing that much for us, and we're making shit tons of money selling cruisers to baby boomers. But what if, but now that they're in this stage where, oh, our core demographic is dying off, now we really do need to switch gears. Now this makes a ton of sense.
Well, when they cut Buell, it was right after, you know, 2007, 2008 financial crash, and Harley was hit pretty hard because their bikes are a luxury item and people were cutting out the luxuries, you know, if you remember all the tighten the belt talk around that time. And they cut them because they were like, well, we're just going to focus on what's always made us money instead of making a commitment to change. So the reason I think this isn't just another dreamy talk about Buell being around is that if Harley with this electric bike stuff and all the, and they've announced that they're bringing out a ton of new models and, you know, they've started making these bikes in India, you know, the Street 500, 750, they're all made and sold in India to try to attract a different market, but also to create these budget bikes that people can buy. If they really are going a different direction, then it's out of step with their philosophy of when they cut Buell, and they could bring them back for nothing. You know, I'm sure they still have tooling and things around to make those frames and all that sort of stuff. I don't think the frames radically changed from the Buell to EBR years. Mm-hmm. I don't think they did. It was a very unique design. I know there were slight tweaks and stuff, and some were longer and some were shorter and all that. But in general, I think they could still create them. And I think they could come up with a product that maybe even if it's only 80, 90% as good as what EBR was doing just, you know, 18 months ago, I think it's still something that people would want to buy. And with the economy of scale that Harley could bring, especially if they could take Eric's designs and have them made out of India and then brought here and assembled and sold really cheap as compared to any other sort of domestic, there's a compelling reason for people to choose American when the cost makes sense, when the philosophy makes sense and the performance is there. And it's also in step with Harley's philosophy. I don't see why it's not a great move.
Right. So it also combines a couple of other things, because it is in line with Harley's vision of, you know, kind of having American heritage, American identity associated with their brand, which Buell 100% is. But it also intersects with the younger market that they're trying to attract now. Now that their core demographic is not really buying bikes at the rate they were anymore. And additionally, you could bring back something that a lot of people hold dear and fits into a younger entry-level model, which is take the Street 500 motor and bring back the Buell Blast.
Okay, they need to bring back the concept of the Blast. Not the Blast itself as it was.
No, this would be an updated bike. Then it would be a twin.
They need to let Buell, Eric Buell, do something insane with it, a la the Honda at M4. Harley needs a couple just really weird out there bikes where he takes the same platform, you know, just let Eric take the same platform and just go, all right, Eric, just create a few different looks for this thing. Just to get those weirdos in the door and into this.
Right. So I think having, you know, a new engine for the Sportster 883 and 1200 that fit within the racing classes for World Superbike and World Supersport are really key. But then outside of those two models, which they can do both naked and full fairing sport bikes, they can then start playing around with some other motors, maybe introduce a couple new motors and, you know, create an entry-level bike, create a 750 that's just fun, that doesn't really fit into any particular class, find some way to make something like the Ulysses again, you know, something that's more...
an adventure bike.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Harley just doesn't have anything in that segment whatsoever, and that's definitely a significant portion of the market now.
Right. But again, you know, if you're doing long distance trips, but within America, you know, if you can bring something in to a shop halfway through your 2 month adventure and it's like, oh, Harley supplies parts for this? Okay, there's a guy down the street, you know, it all kind of comes together in the domestic market.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and Eric would be interested in making dirt bikes for him as well and, you know, design them really well. People would actually want them. There's so many different possibilities. I mean, they could even bring in, like, Craig Vetter to do some crazy design stuff for them. You know, that's another strong American name that they can play on history and heritage there.
A Vetter fairing on a Eric Buell-made adventure bike at Harley
That's a big combination of names, and I would be very, very interested to see what that produced and what that is.
Mm-hmm. I really like the sound of that.
Right? Yeah. I mean, how much can this possibly cost? I mean, Craig Vedder's just tinkering around in his garage making streamliners right now. Eric Buell is like living in a tent somewhere. He tied up all his money in EBR. Like, he's broke. He is a broken man, I'm sure. And my heart goes out to him. You know, Harley, yeah, they're on tough times and they've closed down this factory and everything.
They're still making billions in revenue, though. Like, they still have a lot of money to throw around, even if they're not where they want to be right now.
Right. This is not a crazy pipe dream. You know, the research has been done on these bikes. The design is there. The people that have the knowledge are there. They've just got to put it into production, with the exception of, you know, maybe modifying the Sportster line, which they need to do anyway and should already have a plan to do anyway.
Well, also, if EBR is liquidated, they may just be able to buy the licensing for the Rotax motor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is an amazing motor. The amount of power that they get out of the displacement on that motor for a V-twin. I think I heard Eric Buell say that there was no other production motor on the market at the time for a twin configuration that got as much power and torque out of the displacement as his motor was getting. It's an impressive motor. And I don't see V-twins and all that sort of stuff. Like, why wouldn't Harley want a piece of that?
Yeah, so come on, Harley. Make these bikes. Get them in AMA, get them in World Superbike, let people go to the track, see people racing these bikes, and say, I want one of those.
Yeah, give me a reason to get a Harley Davidson tattoo. You know? Like, I so desperately want to be, like, a Harley fanboy. I really, really do, you know? I've mentioned how, like, when I was a kid, I thought they were the coolest bikes ever, and it just turned out that I'm into a different style of bike. But deep down, I mean, everybody wants to be a Harley fanboy deep down, right? No one wants to okay, we've talked about it. There are some douchebags that want to dislike them, but they're just sorry, sad fucks anyway, right? But I really want to like them. And this would be, I think, something that would grow their business, attract a lot of riders, and allow me to be a huge Harley fanboy. I would just love to throw it in people's faces that I really believe that Harley-Davidson was the greatest motorcycle company on the planet. I would enjoy it to no end. And them going to India or Thailand or wherever to make parts, source parts, get production going in order to make it happen would not detract for me. My current favorite motorcycle manufacturer, Honda, does this shit all over the world, right?
Yeah.
And that's how they are who they are. And Honda really is almost more of an American company than it is a Japanese company anymore. So much of their production is here and their design. Before 1970, Honda set up Honda Motorcycles USA in California when they started making, you know, the CB77 and all that other sort of stuff. Because they didn't think the Japanese wanted, you know, quote, big displacement bikes. I don't know if 305 cc's really ever qualified as a big bike, but it did to Honda at the time, and they moved it here. It's 2018, you know? You can't just think about, like, you know, your own country anymore. You have to think globally for business, and that's fine, you know? Harley has really tried hard to hide what they're doing overseas to people. Just embrace it. And you can still trade on your American legacy. And you can strengthen it by counting on names like Buell and Vedder and things like that. And really tie that into the pride and say, you know what? It's still American based. It's still American ingenuity. And we're relying on these other resources to make it happen. And in doing that, I think they can strengthen everything all the way around. There's no reason they can't win everywhere with a strategy like this. I want them to keep making their big gas guzzling, heavy, ridiculous, gaudy cruisers. No one wants to live in a world where those don't exist.
Right. It's just that we just don't want them to be the be all and end all of the brand.
Exactly. Because there's too much at stake. We don't want to lose Harley. Even if all they're doing is making these big cruisers, we don't want to lose Harley. We want to love Harley forever. So Harley, please, if anyone from Harley's listening, which I highly doubt.
We've laid out the plan. All you got to do is execute.
Yeah. We'll be expecting a check. Okay. I think that's a good place to end this one, right? Yeah. Here we go. Outro. And I don't want to die. Just want to ride on my motorcycle. Go. All right, we'll see you next time. Stay safe and stay tuned.
Later.